Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And today, we are very blessed to have David Seeloff with us. He is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. And as most of the listeners know, David Seeloff carries on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And today, we're going to be talking. It always happens to me. We're going to be talking about the secret key to the Dome of the Rock. And this is going to be really interesting. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne.
Oh.
Yeah, Dr. Martin wrote this article in October 1999,
yeah.
About 9 years ago from the time that we're broadcasting this. And, almost 10 years. And there is a secret key, there's a key message found within two inscriptions in Arabic inscribed on the first cornice supported by large columns that encircles the interior region of the Dome of the Rock. One inscription is found on the outside area of the cornice and the other on the inside area. And both writings provide the real secret to the meaning of the significance behind the Dome of the Rock. That's the introduction that Dr. Martin wrote. Now, some background as to the Dome of the Rock. The Dome of the Rock is the golden-domed, eight-sided structure with a dome on top that many Jews and Christians consider to be the location of that the temple was built, was underneath it, and then the Dome of the Rock was built on top. Not all scholars agree, and certainly Dr. Martin disagrees that it was on the Haram Esharif at all. So, but there is a significance to the Dome of the Rock. And on the Al-Aqsa Mosque platform, they call the Haram Esharif, there is also the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which has a silver dome. It is smaller. The dome is smaller than the Dome of the Rock. And the Dome of the Rock was built not as a place of worship, per se, although Muslims and anyone can pray there, but the Dome of the Rock was built as a shrine to commemorate a particular event that happened in Islam. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is where they go to pray five times a day, particularly on Fridays, where the Muslims go to pray. So let's get into the article then by Dr. Martin from October 1999, The Secret Key to the Dome of the Rock. Once that secret that there is an inscription, and once that inscription is understood, a whole new understanding of early Islam in its relation to Christianity comes on the scene that greatly enhances our comprehension of the theological history of the period. It reveals religious attitudes that existed between early Muslims, Jews, and Christians. There is a linguistic key that has great relevance in knowing why the Dome of the Rock was constructed, and it provides the true meaning for its existence. And once this is realized, it will help divert Muslim attention away from their present attitude of reverent holiness toward the Dome of the Rock, and it will redirect their attention to the Al-Aqsa Mosque located to the south. And this is all historical. It's not necessarily biblical information that we'll be giving today.
Okay.
This new information will also aid Christians to know that the Dome of the Rock was actually built by Abd al-Malik in 692 AD as a rebuilt Christian church that once stood in its place. The rock that sanctified the shrine was first an important Christian holy place and not an early Jewish sacred spot, nor was it the site of the former temples. The first inscription on the outside of the cornice. A cornice is a supporting structure for the dome. The first inscription is meant for all Muslims, and the inner inscription is written for Christians alone. Now, both inscriptions, as Dr. Martin said, were written in Arabic because that was the lingua franca of the people who had conquered Jerusalem. And they expected Arabic as the language that the Quran was written in to take over for a considerable period of time. And indeed, it did. It was the language of the area until about 1917, when the British retook Jerusalem. Jews are not even considered in the context of the inner or even the outer inscription. The analysis of these two inscriptions shows that Abd al-Malik, the builder, built the Dome of the Rock to satisfy Christian religious matters, and it shows that the Dome of the Rock had nothing to do with Jewish matters whatever. The historical evidence shows conclusively that no person was ever interested in any religious or national manner interested in the rock under the Dome of the Rock until the time of the First Crusade. And that means Muslims as well as Christians. The area was never considered a sacred spot for Jews until the time of Benjamin of Tudela in the 12th century A.D. And we have another article that we covered which mentioned this Benjamin of Tudela on the Wailing Wall, a presentation that we did recently.
Yes.
The site of the Dome of the Rock was only of Christian significance before the time of Omar the Magnificent and Abd al-Malik. It only became important to Muslims in the 8th century to the 11th century, and it even only became important to Jews in the 12th century AD. In actual fact, Omar, who was the second caliph and the first Muslim leader to enter Jerusalem, and Abd al-Malik, who came 50 years later, they actually honored the real site of the Jewish temple that was shown to them on the southeast ridge and over the Gihon Springs. And this is the very thing that Omar came to Jerusalem to accomplish. That's the reason he came to Jerusalem, was to learn where the site of the temple was located. But these early Muslim leaders did not show the same type of reverence to the rock now, the rock that is now under the Dome of the Rock. The dome was built by Muslims to wean Christians from the site, not to make it a more sanctified spot in Islam, nor did the building of the Dome of the Rock have anything to do with Jewish religious matters or aspirations. Indeed, the rock underneath the Dome of the Rock was specifically and significantly of Christian importance, and that the Jews, up to the time of the Crusades, showed no interest whatever in this former Christian spot that Abd al-Malik rebuilt as a Christian type of building, even with a characteristic Byzantine dome. And he did this in order to wean Christians, who comprised at least 90% of the population of Jerusalem in the 7th century when the Muslims conquered Jerusalem, from the New Testament teachings — this was his attempt — and to win them over to the doctrines then being taught by Islam in and through the Quran. And now for a question. What was happening at the time the Dome of the Rock was built that inspired this display of theological symbolism in the erection of certain buildings in Jerusalem and also in Mecca? The answer has relevance in knowing prophecy for us today. One of the most volatile geopolitical hotspots on earth today revolves around the national and religious possession of this natural outcropping of an oblong rock located in the city of Jerusalem. That spot is the rock that is presently situated under the building now known as the Dome of the Rock. The building itself is without doubt the most beautiful piece of architecture in the city of Jerusalem, and it represents the centerpiece of religious importance in the holy city for both Muslims and Jews. But strange as it may seem, history shows that Christians also have a stake in its symbolic relevance. Little do Christians know that that rock was first considered by both Muslims and Jews in the early days of Islam as being a Christian holy place and not one that Muslims or Jews thought of as having high religious value. The spot is actually of Christian importance. The real story behind the significance of the site of the Dome of the Rock will cause Muslims and Jews to reevaluate its meaning in relation to their own belief systems that they have erroneously accepted over the centuries since the beginning of Islam. The proper identity of the rock under the Dome of the Rock will truly be a revelation to all religious groups when they discover the truth of its biblical relevance. They will be amazed when they realize that the area was not the site of the former temples of Solomon, Zerubbabel, and King Herod. It was a rock purely of Christian importance, and it was formerly recognized by Christians up until the 7th century, and even historically until the time of the Crusades, as a most prominent Christian site that was singled out in the Gospel of John as the rock that dealt directly with the mission of Christ Jesus to this earth. The early Christians and Jews and Muslims knew this. The reason the dome was built by Abd al-Malik in 692 A.D. was to direct Christians away from that rock and to orient them toward the newly constructed Al-Aqsa Mosque just to the south on the same area, about 50 feet or 50 yards away, which they reckoned to be the rechristened Muslim Temple of Solomon. In other words, holiness was transferred from the temple to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that Al-Aqsa Mosque is located near the south wall of the Haram es-Sharif. If you want a picture of that, you can just Google Temple Mount. And I wish that wasn't a good identifier for Google, but that's the way life is at the present time. Soon you'll be, you know, typing in Temple Mount and you'll get a spot over by the Gihon Springs. But in the meantime, you get the Haram es-Sharif. And you'll get various pictures and diagrams and pictures of the Dome of the Rock. This relocation was intended to further lead Christians directly toward the city of Mecca, where Allah, the Arabic word for God, now had symbolic residence. To understand why the Dome of the Rock was built by Abd al-Malik, we first have to understand how Muslims looked and still look upon the significance of their central shrine in Mecca that is shaped as a cube, as was the Holy of Holies in Solomon's Temple, had the external appearance of a cube. That holy building in Mecca of the Muslims contains the black meteorite stone that the ancient Arabs used to worship in their pagan days, but which Muhammad placed in the southeast corner of his building called the Kaaba, toward which all Muslims must pray 5 times a day, and if possible, visit on pilgrimage at least once in their lifetime. Doesn't matter if you're an American Muslim, you have a right to go on that pilgrimage. Wherever Muslims find themselves in the world, they must direct their prayers toward the direction of the Kaaba in Mecca. When they go on their pilgrimage, they gather at the southeast angle of the cube-style sanctuary. And though the ground-level design is a perfect square, the building is angled so that the corner where the meteorite stone is located is just south of east at about 100 degrees in direction. the required circumambulation, the walking or trotting around the building, begins just opposite this stone, with the people at first facing north toward the region of the heavens, which, to which all biblical peoples believed God dwelt in his heavenly abode. And this is according to Psalm 75 and verse 6. So they have that correct, in fact. The Muslim ritual at the Kaaba has profound astronomical, in reality, astrological significance, and it is designed to mimic the motions of the inner and outer planets within our solar system.
You know, every time they do that and they go in that circle, they trample people, and people get killed. They die.
Yeah, at the big festivals, yeah. Mm-hmm. The temple at Jerusalem had similar astronomical basis, but with an entirely different liturgical motif. There was, in both sanctuaries, a deep symbolism involved, and what was ritualistically accomplished was of religious value. What did the Muslim pilgrims perform at the Kaaba? In the monumental works by Sir Richard Francis Burton in the last century, who was the first Christian or European to clandestinely enter the sacred area of Mecca and describe it in detail, we are informed of the liturgical factors that Muslims were expected to perform when they made their pilgrimage to Mecca. They were to assemble at the southeast corner of the Kaaba and face northward. Each person's left shoulder was always to be toward the building housing the meteorite stone, the idol, in fact, as they circle the structure in a counterclockwise fashion. And this is the same manner, actually, that the Jews entered the temple and exited it. They went around, entered on the east side, and then went around to the right, performed their various duties. Then they came to the altar. They never entered the holy place, because that was for priests, and they never entered the Holy of Holies, of course. But they did their sacrifice, and then they continued around counterclockwise, and then they exited again out of the east side. The Muslims are required to circle the building seven times, the first three with a slow pace, like walking in sand, and the last four they're supposed to do at a faster pace. This represents the movements of the heavenly bodies. The three outer planets, as viewed from the Earth without telescopes, were Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars. They move slowly in the heavens relative to the fixed stars, while the inner celestial bodies, the Sun, Mercury, Venus, and the Moon, appear to move faster. In early astrological view, the Earth was believed to be the center of the universe, with Saturn being the farthest planet away from Earth, with Jupiter nearer and Mars nearer still. Then came the Sun, Mercury, and Venus, and the nearest of all was the Moon. Thus, the first circuit of the Kaaba was in honor of Saturn, the second, Jupiter, and on through to the seventh, the Moon. The last circuit symbolically confirmed the pilgrims as being true Muslims, and their astronomical symbol became the Moon. The Moon was singled out in the seventh circuit of the Kaaba. At the end of the seventh circling, and after having recited certain prescribed prayers at various points in their seven circlings, the Muslim pilgrims found themselves back at the place where they started, opposite the black stone, and again facing north to where God actually was thought to have his residence in heaven. There was much mimicking by early Muslims of the temple rituals performed in Jerusalem by the Jews, as demanded in the scriptures and in Jewish tradition. Muhammad kept the same themes in his ritualistic interpretations. And this is important to know in viewing the architectural design of the Dome of the Rock and the ritual focus intended by Abd al-Malik. So let's get back to the rock at the Dome of the Rock. It was actually of Christian value and of no value to Jewish or Muslim tradition or history. The rock under the Dome of the Rock is the most conspicuous natural feature within the whole of the Haram-e-Sharif. For anyone to build a magnificent shrine over it shows that the rock itself must have had some great significance, and indeed it did. The first Christian pilgrim that has left us a record of his journey to Jerusalem was the Bordeaux pilgrim, who in 333 A.D. mentioned that the most significant building east of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre then being built was the Roman Praetorium, where Pilate sentenced Jesus. Now this structure, had its walls centered directly within the Tiberian Valley. In other words, the western wall was in the valley. This was not the site of the temple in the eyes of the Bordeaux pilgrim. He had already described the temple site and several other buildings around it a few paragraphs before in his description. But only later, after concluding his account of the temple and its associated buildings, did the Bordeaux pilgrim mention the imposing structure to the east of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre with its walls within the valley, which he called the Praetorium where Pilate judged Jesus. And this is from John Wilkinson's excellent translation of the Bordeaux pilgrim in his book, Egeria's Travels, page 158. Clearly, the pilgrim was describing the Haram-e-Sharif as being the Praetorium. He was looking mainly toward the southwest angle of the Haram and northward toward the spot where the Wailing Wall of the Jews is presently located. The Bordeaux pilgrim said this walled area contained the residence of Pilate. It was the Roman Praetorium that also went by the name of Fort Antonia. In Roman usage, the Praetorium was the headquarters of a military unit and could refer to the whole camp or to the commander's tent. There was associated with the military fort a prominent rock. The Apostle Paul was well aware of its significance in Christian history. Within this walled enclosure of the Praetorium was the rock called in John's Gospel, in John 19:13, the pavement stone. And in Greek, this is called the lithostrotos, and in Hebrew, Gabbatha. This particular rock within the Praetorium area had a pavement or flagstones around it. The rock was associated with the Praetorium and was part of Fort Antonia, which was around it. The permanent Roman camp that was located in Jerusalem in the time of Pilate and Jesus. What did Josephus say? And he was the the Jewish historian of the first century, and he had an eyewitness to the early Praetorium of the Romans called Fort Antonia. What did he have to say? He stated that the central feature of Fort Antonia was a major rock. He said, quote, "The Tower of Antonia was built upon or around a rock 50 cubits high and on all sides precipitous. The rock was covered from its base upwards with smooth flagstones." This is in the Jewish Wars, paragraph, book 5, paragraph 238. Before construction of the fortress, the rock was 50 cubits high, 75 feet. But Herod later built a platform around the rock when it became the north-south center of the walled fortress and made it not as high, and it became accessible for judicial purposes. That rock around which Fort Antonia was built and was mentioned by Josephus was the chief geographical feature of the site. It was near this rock that Pilate had his residence at the time of Jesus' trial. Later Christians believed that some indentations in that rock must have come from the footprints of Jesus as he stood before Pilate, and God supposedly allowed his feet to sink into the rock. Though these indentations are not actually footprints of Jesus, a great deal of Christian folklore became associated with that rock. Early Christians came to believe that there were literal outlines, that they were literal outlines of Jesus' feet. It's easy to explain how this conclusion came to be associated with the rock under the Dome of the Rock. The so-called footprints came into vogue when later Christians noticed in the New Testament that a judgment seat was placed by Pilate on that rock, called in Greek, abematos, or abema. That word comes from the root word bema, that literally means footprint, or by common usage, a footstool, where a king or a ruler in judgment would place his feet when he sat on a throne in order to sentence people in any official judicial event. Indeed, even the throne of God was reckoned in the Bible as a spot where God placed his feet below the Ark of the Covenant in the temple, when he sat or stood to make his divine judgments. Psalm 99, verse 5, Psalm 132, and verse 7, and Lamentations 2, and verse 1. Each military governor of the Romans carried his official bema, or bematos, with him, in order to make his judgments on behalf of the emperor. And Julius Caesar carried one with him everywhere he went in order to render official judgments. And you can see this in the article Praetorium in Hastings' Bible Dictionary. Later Christians simply confused the literal meaning of bema, meaning footprint, with the indentations that they saw in the natural outcropping of rock, which became Jesus' footprints. And though this was an error, the reckoning became an indelible identifying mark associated with the rock where Pilate made his judgment against Jesus. This rock, called the pavement by the Apostle John, was well known in the time of Constantine, which was about the early 300s A.D., The records show that Helena, the mother of Constantine, ordered that a small Christian church with the name St. Cyrus and St. John be built upon or over that rock. And this is in The Life of Constantine in Wilkinson's Jerusalem Pilgrims Before the Crusades, page 204. This small church was later enlarged, probably in the 5th century A.D., to become a major church in Jerusalem, called the Church of the Holy Wisdom. This church is described very well and accurately in a 6th century work written by the Piacenza pilgrim. He said, with words in brackets, and remember this is in the 6th century A.D., we, quote, "We also prayed at the Praetorium, where the Lord's case was heard. What is there now is the Basilica of Saint Sophia, the Holy Wisdom Church." By the way, the huge, world's largest church that's ever been built in Constantinople was also called Santa Sophia. Now, this Saint Sophia Church, which is in front or north of the Temple of Solomon, located below the street, east and on the slope side, which runs down to the spring of Siloam outside of Solomon's porch, in other words, the eastern wall of Solomon's temple. In this basilica is the seat where Pilate sat to hear the Lord's case. And there is also the oblong stone, and emphasize this point, that he talks about an oblong stone to help identify the spot. And the oblong stone, which used to be in the center of the Praetorium tent was actually movable. The accused person whose case was being heard was made to mount this stone so that everyone could hear and see him. The Lord mounted it when he was heard by Pilate, and his footprints are still on it. He had a well-shaped foot, small and delicate." End quote. This Church of the Holy Wisdom, which the pilgrim had just described, was built over the oblong rock, which the people thought had the footprints of Jesus embedded in it. Just as Josephus stated that the rock was the most prominent part of Fort Antonia, the Praetorium area, so too this oblong stone was the central feature of the Church of Holy Wisdom that was destroyed by the Persians and the Jewish soldiers in 614 A.D., just before the Muslims erupted out of Saudi Arabia. This is the same rock that is now under the Dome of the Rock in the Haram Esharif. The fact that later Christians thought the footprints of Jesus were embedded in this rock is a key for identification. There are historical references, both Christian and Muslim, that attest that the rock over which the Dome of the Rock now stands was the same rock or stone that had the footprints of Jesus inlaid as foot-like depressions sunk into the rock. Indeed, even as late as the period of the Crusades, we read that the court recorder of Saladin, the Muslim who reconquered Jerusalem from the Crusaders in 1187 AD, made mention of Jesus' footprints, that they were embedded in the rock, underneath the Dome of the Rock. See the article Saladin in Brill's First Encyclopedia of Islam. There are several other Muslim references to these footprints of Jesus in the rock under the Dome of the Rock that I have to present in Dr. Martin's book, The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot. In fact, in the book, Dr. Martin shows that those footprints of Jesus were actually sawn away from the rock and placed in a location within the Haram Esharif, 200 yards north of the Dome of the Rock. This later fact is a most interesting and important aspect of the story. In short, there can be no doubt of the identification. The rock of the Dome of the Rock, which was clearly oblong in shape, and the oblong stone within the Church of the Holy Wisdom were one and the same rock and stone. Sophronius, the Archbishop of Jerusalem in the time of Omar, when the Muslims first conquered Jerusalem, called the Church of the Holy Wisdom, which was still standing before its destruction in 614 AD, as the house and the stone. And this is in Sophronius Antiquaranicta, as translated by John Wilkinson in Jerusalem Pilgrim Before the Crusade, page 91. This fact shows that Sophronius saw great significance in the rock or the stone. That rock, that later became the spot for the Dome of the Rock to Sophronius, was the very stone called the pavement, mentioned in John 19:13, rendered in Greek as the lithostratos, and in Hebrew, gabata. So we're talking about actually a legitimate historical site, not regarding the temple, but regarding the trial of Jesus by Pontius Pilate. It actually took place there. So that when you have, in the past, any of your listeners have visited the Dome of the Rock, and it's much easier for Gentiles to do than Jews. Gentiles are openly able to visit the Dome of the Rock by... You need to make a reservation, I believe. But Jews are forbidden for fear that they might pray there. What a horrible thing that would be. But it's a legitimate historical site. Now, why was the Dome of the Rock built by Abdul-Malik in 692 A.D.? Well, for the first 100 years of Muslim rule in Jerusalem, And since more than 90% of the population was Christian, those years, those 100 years were years of conciliation and ecumenism between Christians and Muslims and between Muslims and Jews. Now, this does not mean that Muslims wanted to embrace the teachings of Christianity, and the Muslims abhorred what they believed to be outright idolatry among the Christians with their statues, pictures, and pagan practices within the Christian community, which was largely Eastern Orthodox in that area at the time. Heavily, heavily influenced with iconography, you know, and icons and little statues and all this stuff. But the Muslims still thought in the early period that they could wean Christians away from their religious beliefs unto the new Islam that God had now revealed to the world by Muhammad. And this was the central reason why Abd al-Malik first devised and designed the building called the Dome of the Rock to be built over the Christian spot where once the Church of the Holy Wisdom had stood. His attempt was ecumenical in spiritual intent, but still to show the superiority of Islam over what Abd al-Malik believed to be a decadent type of Christianity. And the fact is, the Dome of the Rock was built exclusively to vie with and to appeal to Christians in Jerusalem to accept the new truth of Islam, which was, in the Muslim view, a major advance in proper religious interpretation that the peoples of the book, Muslims looking, that's how they consider the Christians and the Jews, because Muslims accept the Old Testament and the New Testament also, although they rarely read it. Peoples of the book altogether ought to have enough sense to accept. And though Jews were also accounted as being people of the book, the construction of the Dome of the Rock was not intended in any manner to influence Jews, either positively or negatively. Because at that time, nobody believed that the temple had been on there at all. After all, Jews would not have reckoned as important a rock that was exclusively a Christian religious site because it was identified with the pavement recorded in the Gospel of John, of John chapter 19, verse 13. So that this Christian religious site was not considered the site of the temple at that period. In a word, Abd al-Malik and the early Muslims felt that they could effectively, in an intellectual and philosophical way, convince Christians that Islam was correct by constructing the Dome of the Rock and to include within it a message from Islam that would glorify Muslim theology. So, Abd al-Malik set out in 692 A.D. to woo the Christians to Islam. What he did was to rebuild in the exact spot and in the precise form the Church of the Holy Wisdom that had been destroyed by the Persians and the Jews in 614 A.D. And he desired it to have as much architectural grandeur as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, just to the west. He then built what looked like a grand Byzantine church directly over that very rock that Christians believed contained the footprints of Jesus. Abd al-Malik did not design the Dome of the Rock as a Christian type, as a Muslim type of building. He wanted it to appear as a rebuilt Church of the Holy Wisdom. And the reason of this is in Dr. Martin's book. The Muslim caliph designed the building to be much like a church, but one that contained the new and, as he understood, the advanced teachings of Islam. Within this new or renewed church, Abd al-Malik placed two inscriptions in Arabic. One was to Muslims in general, the outer inscription, and the other was exclusively for Christians, the inner inscription, next to the rock itself. That inner inscription specifically mentions Jesus and the supposed errors of some Christian doctrines. Abd al-Malik was appealing exclusively to Christians by emphasizing this Christian holy spot through Muslim eyes, not to Jews who did not accept Jesus as the Messiah, as did Muslims and Christians. And in attempting to wean the Christians from their former beliefs onto the new Islam, Abdelmalek had used every architectural artifice and symbolic nuance that he knew of in a brilliant maneuver to woo the Christians of Jerusalem to accept Islam in a non-offensive way. He did so with a deliberate and steadfast allegiance to Muhammad that made Islam the dominant religion, in his view, for all mankind, including those who then accepted Christianity. Now, one must carefully notice every architectural device used by Abdelmalek to see what his intentions were, and they must be minutely observed with utmost precision to the dotting of an I and to the crossing of a T. Every detail of the architecture that the caliph designed was meant to systematically lead Christians, not Jews in this case, to the advanced teachings of Islam as he believed them to be. What a master he was in his endeavor. And though he built the Dome of the Rock as a facsimile of the Church of the Holy Wisdom that had been there previously, there was not the slightest intention on the part of Abdelmalek to give heed to any Jewish person or edifice whatever in the architectural design of the Dome of the Rock. He changed the entrance to the octagonal building from its original design with its entrance on the west. Abdelmalek deliberately altered the entrance to the Dome of the Rock to be from the south. This is most un-Muslim. The ideal for those north of Mecca, like the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, was to enter from the north and pray toward the Qibla, which was the direction of the direction to Mecca. In other words, facing coming in and facing south. Not so the Dome of the Rock. Abdelmalek designed it to be entered from the south with one's back to Mecca, to start at the liturgical theme. Now, why do we know this? Because the two inscriptions in Arabic containing vital information from cardinal verses in the Quran and also a religious commentary by Abdelmalek himself as the successor of Muhammad are a direct appeal to Muslims in general in the outer inscription and then to Christians exclusively on the inner inscription written closer to the rock. A significant feature of the inner inscription is the fact that it can only be read with one's back to the rock. This was intended to give a negative emotional reaction to the reader of the inscription that the architecture was designed to evoke. The inner inscription was not designed to be read by Jews who did not believe in Jesus in the first place, like the Muslims and the Christians. The writings on the cornice were to give definite and decisive positive and negative psychological impressions through liturgical and ritualistic themes that Abdelmalek designed into the architecture. Again, and it is important to note, the caliph did not address any Jews, nor did he show the slightest interest in Jewish matters or religious beliefs when he designed the Dome of the Rock. He built the Dome of the Rock to appeal strictly to Christians and not to Jews. And to read what the two inscriptions state in English, read the excellent translations with outstanding pictures and explanatory texts in Professor Oleg Graeber's book titled The Shape of the Holy. Now, we're going to get into a historical review of what happened surrounding the site of the rock. In 638 A.D., when Omar the Second Caliph went to Jerusalem, right after the Muslims took Jerusalem, captured it from the Byzantine Romans, he asked Sophronius, the Archbishop, to show him where King David had prayed before, in front of the building of the temple. Omar said he wished to pray in the same spot. Sophronius showed him first the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which Omar just rejected. Then Sophronius took the caliph to the traditional Zion on the southwest hill, and Omar rejected that spot also. Then, when Omar stated that he wished to build a shrine at the place where David prayed, Sophronius then took him to the place over and near the Gihon Spring, where the Jews had attempted to rebuild the temple in the time of Constantine, as permitted in the Edict of Milan in 313 AD, and with construction continuing to 325 AD, at which time Constantine cut off the ears and mutilated those who were involved in the construction, so that nobody can work on the temple if they're deformed. And also in the time of Julian the Apostate in 362 AD. At that former temple site over the Gihon Spring, Omar was impressed. He dug through the filth in the ground and found a stone that he removed and took it through the southern gate of the Haram Esharif. And there he placed it near the Qibla, the site toward which Muslims pray as they bow toward Mecca. He put it on the elevated platform directly abutting the southern wall. He called the place the Al-Aqsa, and a mosque was soon to be built there. But one of Omar's generals, named Ka'ab, who was a recent convert from Judaism and who had extensive Christian indoctrination, found the place of the rock where the former Church of the Holy Wisdom once stood. He told Omar that it would be better to place the Qibla north of this rock and not down at the southern end of the Haram. Omar rejected the suggestion of Ka'ab, and chided the general for making such a suggestion. That would have given much prestige to that rock in the north, and Omar steadfastly refused. He turned his back on that rock where the Christian church once stood, and he went back south a few, 50 yards or so, to the Qibla of the Al-Aqsa area. It's all within the same platform. The truth is, Omar, in his role as the second caliph after Muhammad, and the divine successor of Muhammad in Muslim theology, totally rejected that northern rock. And later, Abd al-Malik wanted to show a further rejection by building the dome over that northern rock some 50 years afterwards. Now let me explain how this rejection is designed into the dome. The original entrance designed by Abd al-Malik was from the southernmost octant of the octagonal design. Once a person entered the dome, he was directed to read the start of the first inscription that was located at the top of the cornice on the far right of the southern octant. Since Arabic, like Hebrew, is written from right to left, the first inscription contained no message for Christians, and it was meant for Muslims in general. To read the whole inscription, one must start with one's back to Mecca, and this is important to note, but then circle around the whole dome clockwise, just the opposite from what Muslims do in circling the Kaaba at Mecca, until one comes to the exact spot where one commenced his reading. When one returns to this southern point, the person can conveniently turn his back to the rock and pray directly toward Mecca in the south. The design of the outer message is to circle the rock in the wrong direction, which gives a negative impression to any early Muslim, Jew, or Christian. But the complete encirclement requires one to return to the south again, and the person is forced to face Mecca when one leaves the dome, with one's back to the rock, as Omar insisted one must do. And Abd al-Malik designed this symbolic stance with one's back to the rock, into the liturgy associated with the architecture of the Dome of the Rock. The inner inscription is different. One must go further into the dome to the other side of the same cornice and look up at the southern, at the same southern octant. But to its far left side, if one is facing the rock. Indeed, one must look at its far left side only when facing the rock itself, but inside the inner area of the dome, one must look southerly and also upwards at the start of the inscription, which will be seen on one's upper right-hand side. This requires a person to have his back to the rock and looking upward toward Mecca. To read the inner inscription, one must crane the neck upward to see the start of the inscription that is circling and facing the rock. One then begins to read the inscription in Arabic, devoted strictly to Christians, not to Jews, because the whole emphasis of the message is about the importance of Jesus in Muslim theology. One must read this inscription, which completely encircles the dome, like the outer one in the opposite direction, but one must do it in a counterclockwise manner, as one does at Mecca, which is a positive indicator. But this time with one's back to the rock, another positive sign from a Muslim point of view, and a negative one as far as Christians would view it. Now note this important point. All the time that a Christian is reading the teaching from Abd al-Malik in the inner inscription, he has to do so with his back deliberately turned away from the rock, with his head craned upward, in the most uncomfortable position that one can imagine. The whole anatomical awkwardness forced upon the human observer is a deliberate attempt to show disdain for the symbolic meaning that the Christians had placed on the rock. The original symbolism for Christians was different. The Christians entered the domed church from the west, and they looked eastward toward the Mount of Olives, where the resurrection, crucifixion and resurrection actually did take place. Once the circuit of the rock was made, the Christian could again look through the rock eastward toward Olivet in a symbolic anticipation for the second advent, where Christ is to come back from the east as the sun in its circuit around the earth. However, Abd al-Malik designed the Dome of the Rock to be entered from the southern octant. But even if a Christian entered from the south, as designed by Abd al-Malik, through his circuit around the rock, would be all negative to Christianity because his or her back would always be away from the rock while reading the inner inscription. The Christian, upon completing the circuit, could simply refuse to face Mecca when his circuit ended in the south. He could then turn directly northward and pray through the rock, which symbolized the rule of Christ in his or her life, and direct his ultimate attention to the north quarter of the sky, where all people knew that God the Father had his residence. If Abd al-Malik saw a Christian do this after the circuit deposited the person in the south, then Abd al-Malik knew that the person would never be a Muslim and the Christian would be accepted as a person of the book, the Holy Scriptures, but inferior to Muslims. Thus the person would then pay the poll tax to the Muslims and carry on with his own beliefs. Still, when one completed the circuit by reading either the outer or the inner inscription in order to exit the Dome of the Rock as intended by Abd al-Malik, the person is forced to face directly toward Mecca. But there is one additional thing indeed. The person is also facing directly toward the Al-Aqsa Mosque established by Omar the Second Caliph and directly through the former site of the Holy of Holies of Solomon's Temple. Because the Muslims at that time knew where Solomon's Temple that it was formerly located over the Gihon Springs. The prayer of the Muslim would traverse Solomon's Temple and focus onward to the Kaaba in Mecca. Every device imaginable was used by Abdelmalek in his building of the Dome of the Rock to direct people, both Christians and Muslims, away from any significance of the Dome of the Rock, just as Omar had demanded when he was at first in Jerusalem. This is because it was well known in the 7th century that the rock was actually a Christian holy spot. What is most important for us of modern times to realize is the fact that the site of the rock under the Dome of the Rock is purely and simply a Christian holy place before the time of Omar and Abdelmalek, and it did not become a Muslim holy site until many folklore traditions about the night journey of Muhammad began to be associated with the rock, which began about the 8th century on, up until the time of the Crusades. And this is in Dr. Martin's book, The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot. How the many Muslim mythic accounts of myth, which were outright fables and lies, that even Muslim historians admit to be so, erroneously got attached to the rock under that Dome of the Rock. As for Jews, no Jew showed any interest whatever in the rock and the Dome of the Rock until the time of the First Crusade. This is an absolute fact. For more information, there's other articles on the ASK website. So the Dome of the Rock was built over a prime Christian holy place where the Church of the Holy Wisdom was once situated. And by the way, that Church of the Holy Wisdom was also octagonal. A lot of churches in the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Orthodox area, were built in an octagonal shape. They were tended to be smaller, not like the huge Church of the Holy Sepulchre or later churches like Santa Sofia in Constantinople, but some of the smaller churches were built octagonal, so the Dome of the Rock is essentially built on almost the same superstructure, on the same foundation as the Church of the Holy Wisdom, as Dr. Martin says. Abdelmalek built the Dome of the Rock with the intended purpose of getting Christians to forget the rock on which Jesus was judged at the time of Pilate, and Abdelmalek wanted Christians to abandon the Christian significance of the rock by having them turn their backs to it. And he wanted Christians to convert to Islam and then focus on the Kaaba stone where Muslims supposed Abraham erected at Mecca in Arabia for the true worship of God. And as I said, this and more details are given in Dr. Martin's book, The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot. And there are many other historical facts there also.
You know, David, I'm not trying to be rude to anybody's beliefs, but I think worshiping a rock is kind of dumb. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I'm honest to God, I am not trying to be rude to anybody, but worshiping a rock is...
Well, the idols of the Old Testament were made out of stone, too.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Now, you know, they never actually believed that that was the god, but they believed that the spirit of some essence was in that god if it was dedicated to him, and that he sometimes did things, you know, in the temple, and there was actually a give and take, you know, by these supernatural entities with this stuff, just like there are... I have a friend of mine. His 89-year-old mother lived in Yugoslavia area in a Catholic town, and there were all sorts of miracles associated with the, you know, with the statues.
Yeah, like waking up in the morning when you're 89.
Yeah, you know? But she remembers as a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, she would have to get up, going early before dark, and she would see lights on the hillside coming out of the shrines, and they weren't people. You know, there was nobody there, because when it got light, the lights were there. There were no people, and then the lights faded away. There are all sorts of, you know, things going on. That's why all these folk tales continue to this day, and folk religion, and all these superstitions, because they had a... There were things that responded to these rituals.
Yeah, things is right.
And things is right, yeah. I mean, these ancient people weren't stupid.
No, they weren't.
They did things because there was a cause and effect. If you do this cause, you will get this result.
Uh-huh.
If you do this ritual, you will get this result. And, you know, if it doesn't happen after a while, then these religions and these sites die. They just fall, you know, why observe them? The gods aren't responding.
Yeah.
Polybius, a priest of Delphi, wrote an entire book it's a part of a book called The Cessation of Oracles. And he was a priest at Delphi, and it was a famous oracle from the time of Homer and even before, up until the first century A.D.
Mm-hmm.
And the spirit or the god stopped responding, as did the pit python spirit in Ephesus. Like we've discussed before, it could very well be because of the Apostle Paul. He put an end to it. But you're right. Praying to a rock, it's the height of foolishness.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's interesting that there is a historical basis for that rock. Was probably the site where, you know, Jesus did stand in front of Pilate, because it would have been the center of the Roman fortress where the adjudication took place.
Yeah.
Now, when Pilate took Jesus out to confront the Jews, he had to take them to a neutral place where the Jews could stand and still be ritually impure by standing near a Gentile. Or, a sinner. Jesus was a sinner, but he was still considered a Jew, so they could still whip him and, desecrate him.
This business of pure, impure, your body's got to be pure. Everybody that's born has worms.
Yeah.
This business, you're impure, you can't, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that whole thing, though, that was with the law of Moses. It was Moses who started it.
Yeah.
Or, God's had Moses do that. He's the one who set up the pure and the impure.
Yeah.
And I think much of the pagan impurity and purity rituals and laws are, we will someday find, you might want to ask Robert Bowie Johnson about this, that may have been, probably have their derivation from the Jewish, because let's face it, the Jews set the standard, because they could demonstrate that it came from God. And all this, they're all perversions. Just like, look at all the big churches. They're set up like little temples. With a holy place, a holy of holies, which is the altar, and then the holy place, where there's a barrier, and then the priest gives you communion. He stays on one side, and you stay on the other.
Just like a courtroom. Yeah.
Same structure.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, but, my thing about the worms, I mean, and it just, some people get very offended and horrified to think that a newborn baby has worms. They get it from their mother.
Mm-hmm.
It's internal. And, ritual purity, my, you've got worms, you're not pure. Why doesn't the scripture address that?
Well, the purity laws are also have some health benefits.
Well, yeah.
But compared to what we do today for hygiene, they were, we would be shocked and stunned.
Yeah, they were
how
very
they lived.
Primitive, yeah.
Yeah. And yet they were an advance around the an advance from the, you know, the Gentiles, the nations that lived around them.
Right.
And when the Jews, during the diaspora, lived among the Gentiles, you know, they were always a step above in terms of hygiene.
Uh-huh.
And because they didn't get the plague, everybody thought that, you know, they caused the plague.
Yeah.
In some cases, whatever the plague might have been, not just, you know, the Black Death, but,
yeah.
You know, other things as well. Simple hygiene actually has done more to bring about in world history the longevity than any modern medicine has, anything modern medicine has done.
Yeah, well, modern medicine has done a lot to ravish the immune
mm-hmm.
systems and the health of people and destroy it totally.
But modern hygiene requires a great deal of infrastructure.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sewers and clean water being brought to everyone, but then also sewers to, you know, cast away the waste, you know, waste management to take our
right.
garbage away.
Right.
All that stuff is important for a modern functioning and a clean and healthy society. And the purity laws, like I said, have some minor benefit, and some say actually a great benefit.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the Jews didn't eat pork, but the cattle they had intestinal parasites.
Oh, of course.
Sure.
Yes, absolutely.
And the sheep
and birds and rabbits and, you know.
Yeah, yeah, well, they didn't eat rabbits, but
yeah
the birds that they would eat, even the doves.
Sure.
So, and their water, and not only that, but they didn't have variety of food.
Yeah.
That's why people tend to, you know, the populated areas are not in the northern regions until central heating comes along, simply because, you know, you're not as healthy.
Yeah.
You don't have the variety of food and the trade necessary. I mean, you have a long winter a couple of times, and your people in the cities are in big trouble.
Yes.
That's something we forget, is most of the world has been hand-to-mouth for, you know, up until 200 years ago.
Yeah, well, they're trying to make the world go back to hand-to-mouth here real fast.
Mm.
Oh.
So I hope you found this interesting.
Very, very interesting, David.
So when you hear, you know, the central focus of the world will someday be on this little piece of land in Jerusalem, and both the true temple site and the false temple site, the Fortress Antonia. So it's, and there's a whole substructure underneath the Dome of the Rock. We went down there in 83 with Dr. Martin. Of course, he had no clue on any of this stuff that we're reading these last several sessions back then. So all this develops since I went there with him. I've been back since, but not under the Dome of the Rock. I'd like to get there. It is a very, very beautiful building. It's not on the par with the Taj Mahal, but it was the most beautiful building of the age.
Well, I will say one thing. The Arab peoples have a knack for, I think, I mean, in my opinion, beautiful architecture.
Yeah, and design of, I mean, their writing is, you know,
mm-hmm.
calligraphy, I mean, let's say so.
Yes, very artistic.
How they can type it, I have no idea, but I guess they do.
Oh my goodness, yes. Well, are we at the end of our journey here?
Yes.
Okay, this has been very interesting, David.
Oh, there's one thing I want to add, is that for the first 17 years of Islam, Muhammad insisted that every believer in Islam pray toward the site of the temple. And after that time, after 17 years, because of their sins, this is in Dr. Martin's book, because of their sins, Muhammad allowed people to pray to the Kaaba because they were doing it anyway.
Hmm.
So, you know, there's problems in all religions.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's interesting that he had them actually pray to the true site of the temple for 17 years. And I presented in front of Muslim groups of, you know, 100 or so scholars, and they agreed. They said, yes, you're right.
Wow.
He absolutely did do that.
You know, when you talk about the footprints of Jesus, there's also a story about the hoofprints of Muhammad's horse.
Yes, yes, that's how the Muslims interpret those marks.
Oh, okay.
Or marks, other marks that are on there.
Yeah.
And that those footprints would be Muhammad's, and that the that there's other hoofprints, and it's the hoofprints that prove that, you know, Muhammad was there, and that it wasn't Jesus whose footprints.
Yeah.
that's good evidence. That'll convince me.
Oh yeah, right. Oh,
I don't think so.
Any moment.
Yeah.
Oh, God bless you, David Seeloff. Thank you so much. This concludes our journey today. Very interesting material, David. Thank you so much. And everybody, go check out the website at askelm.com. ELM stands for Ernest L. Martin. And David Seeloff can be contacted through the Ask Elm website. You can email David at this address. It's david@askelm.com. And thank you so much, everyone out there, for listening. And God willing, we will be back with more very interesting information. Very thought-provoking, David.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.